नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय भगवते वासुदेवाय श्री सुख उवाच इति लाला ननुयाति विशारदो ग्राम्यम् इति लाला ननुयाति विशारदो ग्राम्यम् वैधाग्यया परिभाषयातम् विभुदयादुं विभुदामतीर् दवादुं विभुदामतीर् Adisa Bajayamasa. Sri Sukha Uvacha. Sukadev Goswami said, Iti, thus, Lalana, women, Anunaya, in winning over, Ati Visaradha, very expert. Gramhya Vaidhagyaya, expert in fulfilling one's material desires. Paribhasaya, by selected words. Tham, her. Vibhudha Vadum, the celestial girl. Vibhudha Mati, Agnidra, who possessed intelligence like that of the demigods. Adisa Bajaya Masa, gained the favor of. Translation, Sukadev Goswami continued, Maharaj Agnidra, whose intelligence was like that of a demigod, knew the art of flattering women to win them to his side. He therefore pleased that celestial girl with his lusty words and gained her favor. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Since King Agnidra was a devotee, he actually had no attraction for material enjoyment. But because he wanted a wife for progeny, and Lord Brahma had sent Purvachati for this purpose, he expertly pleased her with flattering words. Women are attracted by a man's flattering words. One who is expert in this art of flattery is called Vidagdya. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasme Shri Guruve Namaha. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shimati Indudumna Swami Tinamine Nama Prabhupada Puryodas Jagannath Yatrananda Muti Bhakti Sukriya Krishna Ketanena Narasimhena Raksitena Namaha. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tinamine Namaste Sarasati Devam Gauravani Prachanine Vishesha Sanivari Paschatya Desatarine. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th Canto, Chapter 2, Text 17, which is the creative impulse. Excuse me for my voice and all these, the frog that I have in my throat. I've been suffering with the flu for the past 1.5 weeks or so, and when Manohar Prabhu first approached me to give the class, I said to him, I've got the flu, but when he asked me again after a few days, I said, okay, I'd do it, hoping that the flu would have been gone by today, but it doesn't seem to have gone away as yet. So this particular chapter is dealing with King Agnidra and the fact that he had approached Lord Brahma for the purposes of gaining good progeny, as he wanted to, at the end of this lifetime, go to Pitarloka, to where his ancestors would be. And in order to go to that particular planet, one would need a son who would be able to perform the necessary rituals so that the deceased soul would benefit. And so, as this was his desire, that at the end of the lifetime that he'd go to Pitarloka, he needed to have a son to ensure that his future would be that Lord Krishna would be appeased and that he would attain this goal. So Srila Prabhupada in this purport mentions that King Agnidra was actually a devotee. He had worshipped Brahma, as I had said, so that he could have the son. And to have the son, he needed to obviously have a wife. And he wanted a good wife. And so much so that the wife that he desired to have was from was to be from a family of the demigods. She was not an ordinary woman, because he wanted to have a really good progeny. And this brings forth the point of the Grihastha Ashram, that the purpose of the Grihastha Ashram is actually to raise God-conscious, Krishna-conscious children, and so that they can also deliver the previous generations and the future generations as well. And also in Srimad Bhagavatam, it is stated later on that no one should become a king, a teacher, or father if he cannot deliver his dependents. So that is the proper duty of a parent. However, at the same time, that particular verse itself lends itself to a whole lecture on the purpose of parenting and our responsibility as parents. But in particular, in this particular chapter, we're dealing with King Agnidra and his desire to have good progeny, and therefore his selection of a wife and his desire to have a wife who is a very of a very high caliber, good quality woman amongst the ranks of those of the demigods. So, when we are choosing our wives or our spouses, rather, one should naturally have the similar kind of value system that we have. If your aspiration is to become Krishna consciousness, is to go back to Godhead in this particular lifetime, then one should choose a spouse that can assist you and has that similar value or a similar desire to go back to Godhead in this lifetime. And in that way, we can nicely cooperate with each other and assist each other in attaining that particular purpose. So, in this material world, lust exists. And as it is said, that lust is a perverted reflection of that which actually exists in the spiritual world, which in its unadulterated form is actually love, and which is exhibited by Lord Krishna in his relationship with the gopis. But as conditioned living entities, we cannot experience that love, and what we term as love and use so loosely in our relationships is nothing more than lust. But we must also try to overcome that lust, and it can be done by using by dovetailing our senses in Lord Krishna's service. Therefore, this institution of marriage has been created so that we can overcome these material desires of ours in a proper fashion by entering into the Grihastha Ashram, which is a regulated system. It's not that one enters into marriage so that one can continue to enjoy sinful activities. Marriage is not a license to commit sinful activities, but rather to regulate oneself to attain that ultimate goal in life. In Vedic times, in Indian culture particularly, parents would find the suitors for their child. Marriages were arranged. It's not like how currently or commonly a boy meets a girl, they fall in love, so-called love, and then they desire to get married, and then they have children, and that's the institution of marriage. Previously, what would happen is that the parents would actually look into the compatibility of the spouse for their child. So currently we have so many issues. We have a high rate of divorce. And one of the greatest reasons for that is because of the incompatibility between the partners. But if at the outset, people are careful in the choice of their partners, and they properly understand maybe it's not the word to use, but research, go into the background of the person, understand the person's, the way they think, what's their outlook on life, and how they view certain issues, what's their opinions on things, one would be able to ascertain, is this a suitable person, are we like-minded, or do our value systems and our aspirations differ? So in Vedic times, one would actually consult astrologers, one would look at the compatibility in that way, and at the same time, one would want to marry one's child off to someone who would be on the similar class, so to speak. In Varnashram Dham as well, it would be ideal for a Brahmana girl to marry someone from a Brahmana family as well. So in this way, they would maintain and ensure that there is no imbalance in the relationship. not that one is that one of the spouses is dominant and the other one is considered to be very can be dominated over because of the imbalance in the relationship and in the intellectual levels as well. And also at the same time, there was training, because before one would go into Grihastha ashram, one would have ideally been situated in the Brahmacharya ashram. And in that Brahmacharya ashram, boys and girls were trained. And eventually when the transition occurred, it was not that someone was not trained, or they were just grown up as and then chose to get married and got married. So there was proper training that... so that eventually that brahmachari, when he entered into Grihastha ashram, he did so knowing that it is a progression into another ashram, which is also to continue on his path of devotional service. Not that suddenly one's devotional service ends and one is getting involved in engaging in a relationship with the opposite sex, but it was to further that spiritual path. Right. And then marriage and friendship are proper between two people who are equal in terms of their wealth, birth, influence, physical appearance, and capacity for good progeny. But in Srimad Bhagavatam, later in the 10th canto, it said it's but never between a superior and inferior. And we would want our life's partner to be a true peer. So in that way, it sets the tone for a good, healthy married life together. Because if the choices are made correctly, then likewise the sustainability and the maintenance of that marriage is one that is ensured. And then we see as well in Vedic times, in historic incidents that are described in the Ramayana, in the Mahabharata, that amongst the Kshatriyas, women had the choice. They had the option of even choosing their suitors, because they were considered very intelligent women, educated women. So at that, in amongst Kshatriya women or the royalty, the women were given the option of choosing their spouses. But there again, it was with the parental supervision. And the examples are like with Sita, with Draupadi, because they were of royalty, they would already have expressed their desire to marry a certain personality, but then the fathers would arrange like a swayamvar so that the most capable of men would become suitable suitors for their daughter to win their hand in marriage. And so it was a challenge that if you were the person to have conquered this task, then you are worthy of my daughter. It was not like whimsically choosing or leaving it upon them to choose, and then that person would become their life partner. So as I explained, in this day and age, lust is so prevalent, and then that lust needs to be dovetailed in Krishna consciousness. And the example is given that, we could sort of compare it with the example of when one has too much of milk, it causes diarrhea. And then there's the stomach is unsettled. But that same milk product in a different form, such as yogurt or curd, and when prescribed and taken with some medication under the prescription of a physician, can cure that same disease condition that was induced by that same milk. So in this way, when lust is dovetailed and used in Krishna consciousness, one can cure oneself of one's lusty desires and instead use it as a tool. But there again, it is under the instruction of a physician. So it's not like we can choose upon or decide by ourselves that, yes, I have this lusty desire, so I should change and go into Grihastha ashram, and then I'd marry someone, and then in that way I would be able to cure myself of this disease condition. But rather it is under the instruction, medication is prescribed by the physician. So therefore we should take instruction and guidance from others who we consider to be our authorities, from the spiritual master, from senior grihasthas who can advise us in our choice of partners, in our guidance of how to approach the grihastha ashram itself. And we see that currently, because of the prevalence of the high rate of divorce statistics in the world, other institutions, even the churches, are now making it somewhat compulsory. Certain churches have chosen that before you enter into married life, one should go into some sort of counseling system. And that is done with the view to reduce the risk of marriages ending in divorce. So they put the prospective spouses into a counseling system, into educating them, to assisting them with their choices, and eventually assisting with the marriage arrangements, and subsequently providing further support during the marriage itself. And in this way, it's done with the hope that marriages won't end in divorce, but that there is a support system in place. And rather, one discovers before one gets married that this is not going to work out, then entering into the institution of marriage and bringing forth children and having the children exposed to this discord in the family situation and the difficulties that are then experienced, and children being left in situations where there is a single parent, or that the parents are divorced and the family unit is split up. So, and people are becoming so careful right now when they enter into marriages, or some portion of them are becoming so careful because they understand the risks attached to marriage as well, is that some have gone to the extent of prenuptial agreements. And in my experience as an attorney, or as a lawyer, as you may call them, you find many people coming forth to ask, I'd like to have an antenuptial contract drafted. Because what are they worried about? They're worried about protecting their assets. Because in the event of this marriage ending, so they're already planning, if this marriage has to end in divorce, at least my assets, what I brought into this marriage, what I acquired of my own hard work, will be protected. So that even if we have to part ways, so this is the extent that people are concerned about planning in the future. When this marriage ends in divorce, then we have our assets separate, and that. So it's also done with that kind of mentality, which shows that you are anticipating divorce in the future. And to be a husband or a wife, in Srila Prabhupada's words is, and I quote from Srimad Bhagavatam, the earlier canto of third canto, is actually a duty performed in mutual cooperation as directed in the authoritative scriptures for spiritual advancement. Therefore, marriage is essential in order to avoid the life of cats and dogs who are not meant for spiritual enlightenment. So, cats and dogs don't need to get married to procreate, to have, to produce their young. But marriage is there for us to have children, but it is not to live lives of cats and dogs, just having children without following rules and regulations. So even within grihastha ashram, there are so many rules and regulations to be followed. And as the ideal grihastha, one should, from the moment of the marriage ceremony, the various samskaras that we perform, even for creating good progeny, there's the garbhodan samskara. We create our consciousness, or we heighten our consciousness to the point that even the act of procreation is precursed by the fact of that we are planning this pregnancy. We are meditating on Krishna in anticipation of bringing forth a good soul that would be raised as a devotee in this life. So our role as parents is going to be to raise God-conscious children. So we accept the role of a husband or wife so that we can gradually become the best devotee we are capable of being. So it's when a person becomes a husband or wife, it's to further improve themselves. So their goal is still the same, that I am going to become a better devotee, I am going to be the best devotee possible within my ability. So the first and overriding principle in the husband and wife relationship is the unrelenting desire of both individuals to make their marriage work in Krishna consciousness. Not that this institution is now, like I said previously, a license to now have sexual relationships in an uncontrolled kind of fashion. So Srila Prabhupada also writes in Nectar of Devotion, he says that when a young boy or girl sees a member of the opposite sex, there is a natural attraction without the need for any introduction. Without any training, there is natural attraction due to the sex impulse. So prior to marriage, this natural attraction for the company of the opposite sex may lead to flirting, dating, dallying in coyness, sexual innuendos being presented. And such casual premarital relationships deny young men and women the fortitude of celibacy in mind. So that is why this Brahmacharya Ashram is there to train one in celibacy and also assist one in controlling one's words and deeds. And if we are trained well in the Brahmacharya Ashram, then it will assist us when the choppy waves of unnecessary indulgences pose themselves to us in our Grihastha Ashram. Because Grihastha Ashram also exists, and when you in that ashram, you'd have that opportunity to engage, like I said, in giving vent to one's desires, to engage with the opposite sex. But because if one is trained properly, one would be able to control those kind of impulses and ensure that it is used and one's spouse is not exploited for one's sense gratification. And, unfortunately, in this present civilization, both men and women are allowed to be attracted to one another from the very beginning of life. And because of this, they are completely unable to come to the platform of self-realization. We see that even in our daily lives as grihasthas, it depends on how much of control you exercise over your children. We may not necessarily have the Brahmacharya institution right now where one sends one's child off to the Gurukul under the instruction or guidance of the spiritual master, and the person is trained up to be an impeccable brahmachari or an impeccable brahmacharini. So whilst Shishi Radha Gopinath ki, so whilst that child is under our care and being raised under our care as grihasthas, as the parents, it is our responsibility as far as possible to train them in a way that they are understand that one cannot have indulge in loose sense gratification. So restriction in so many ways exists under the guidance of the parents. And in this way, if they are educated properly, even under the guidance of the parents, then they can very nicely transition into the next phase of the Varnashram system. And so, like also it said that in the Brahmacharya Ashram, one is trained and one then develops noble and godlike characteristics. And in this way, it will become attractive as well. And one would attract a like-minded person. And it says, before entering the household life, this is from Srimad Bhagavatam, from 5th Canto, Chapter 1, Text 18. Before entering a household life, a student is fully trained to become Jitendriya, a conqueror of the senses. So here again it goes back to the earlier ashram. In that Brahmacharya ashram, one is trained to become conqueror of the senses. So as and when and if one chooses to go into Grihastha ashram, one does so with all that good grounding and solid foundation, so that one is able to control one's senses even in Grihastha ashram. Right. And then to reiterate the point that the ultimate goal of life is spiritual growth of the individual. So as individuals, we are coming together. The man is an individual, the female is an individual. And if they have that goal of life, to become Krishna consciousness, to aspire to go back to Godhead in this lifetime, so it's a journey one takes in life. And we must understand, as individuals, when we come together, we're coming together to assist each other in attaining that common purpose. So successful training will lead to that successful marriage. But ultimately, during that marriage and at the end of one's lifetime, it's not that one's spouse can take you back to Godhead. It's you that's going to charter your path back to Godhead. So at times during marriages as well, one partner may not be progressing as as well as the other in attaining that goal. But that does not mean to say that one leaves that partner lagging behind. So it can work in both ways. Maybe the woman in the marriage, the wife in the marriage, is more serious about her Krishna consciousness. So she should actually assist her husband. And I remember Bhakti Chura Swami once giving a class and saying that the role of the mother and the wife in the marriage is to ensure that, she keeps on pushing her family She keeps on pushing her husband to get more involved in devotional service, to get more involved in his Krishna consciousness. She is the one that actually pushes the children, to get more serious and to be more engaged and creates and finds those opportunities for them to be engaged in Krishna consciousness. And it may work vice versa as well. If the husband sees the wife lagging behind, it's not that he moves on with his Krishna consciousness, leaving her to be the way she is. That's a responsibility that he takes at the point of marriage as well, to protect the wife and to assist her in a Krishna consciousness. And those vows are taken both ways. So in that way, whilst at the end of one's lifetime, where one is in one's spiritual life will determine one's future birth. And it's not like if my husband is very Krishna consciousness, automatically I will go back to God. It's so I can sit back and relax. And on his ticket, I will gain my pass. It doesn't work that way. Each one determines their own future birth by their own activities in this lifetime. And another important point in marriage, I felt that I should mention that compatibility also includes living with one spouse's faults. So anyone can live with someone's good qualities. But can you live with that person's weaknesses? And that's one of the challenges that comes in marriage as well. Is that, before marriage, one is on one's ideal behavior. We want to impress the other person. We want them to see the good in us, and we really want to see the good in the other person. And like in the verse itself, it said that King Agnidra actually used flattering words. That is part of like courtship. We want to impress the other person. We want them to see in us what they want, what is their ideal suitor. So in this way, we always are now, the man is attracted, oh, she's got such good qualities, she's the ideal wife, and likewise the woman is attracted, he's such a good devotee, he's such an ideal person, and he's going to make such a good husband. But as you begin to live with each other and the trials and tribulations of daily life and the challenges posed by married life come to the fore, then one is not so cautious anymore in keeping up these appearances. And so what happens at that stage? Do we throw in the towel and the first option that we have is divorce? But no, it should become an institution which is for life. And that we've taken these vows, we should take it seriously enough that I accept someone's weaknesses and I will try to look at their strengths and their good qualities. And in doing so, in looking at the positives, we can try and say, yes, he may not be so good in this way, but he's so good in other ways. And by also saying that, I say that with a rider to it. That doesn't mean to say that either of the spouses could have these inadequacies and continue to maintain those inadequacies and not be willing to see things from the other spouse's perspective. So one should try to meet each other halfway, to reach some sort of compromise. Not that because I have this weakness, I'm not willing to change and I'm not willing to improve myself. If it is a genuine inadequacy, yes, we should try to get some assistance to improve ourselves so that we could become better spouses. And of course, when children are there, we should become, for their sake at least, become ideal parents, because we are going to be setting the examples for them to later follow in their lives. And if we are not that ideal example and conduct ourselves in the as proper parents and as proper husbands and wives, so what examples are we setting for the next generation to follow? If the parents can be seen as abusing each other in the relationship, it's not long thereafter that the child can backchat the parent, because the parents are doing it in their presence. So what prevents them from doing that in the future? How do you then discipline that child if you have exhibited it yourself? So in that way, whilst there are those weaknesses, we should endeavor, concerted effort in trying to ensure that we work together to improve ourselves and then assist each other to honor our vows and to honor and respect each other in that way as well. And also, a valid point would be that the more one advances in Krishna consciousness, the less one is affected by another's failings. And conversely, the more neophyte we are, the more those failings will irritate us. Because we will be more prone to seeing the negative things, to looking for the inadequacies of the partner, because we are looking for it elsewhere. And and the fact that, you know, this person is not satisfying myself, satisfying me to the extent that I expected. Excuse me. So better I end this marriage and find someone else. Marriage shouldn't be like that, that we end one marriage and find somebody else. It's not like a trial and error situation. If it doesn't work here, we'll move on and try and make it work somewhere else. We should try to make it work within that institution, and only as a last resort, you know, if it just cannot work. Some people are in an abusive relationship, and we don't necessarily say, okay, you've got to stay in that marriage regardless of the fact that you're being abused. But if you've had that taste of marriage once, you realize that, you know what, it's not something, it's like chewing the chewed. You know, and hopefully someone would want to go through that process again in this lifetime to try and see if it could still work with someone else. And also another important, you know, to assist us in our Grihastha Ashram is that if we understand and if we make Krishna the center of our lives, Krishna the center of our home, and we orient everything in our affairs, in our home, in our family, and inculcate that kind of mood in the home where we have deities, where everything is done around the deities and around Krishna, then we're very conscious of our conduct, of our how we treat each other, because we are in the mood of you know, maintaining our Krishna consciousness and improving on it as well. According to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said that a husband and wife can turn their home into places as good as Vaikuntha, even while in this excuse me, in this material world. Being absorbed in Krishna consciousness, even in this world, husband and wife can live in Vaikuntha simply by installing the deity of the Lord within the home and serving the deity according to the direction of Shastras. So when we worship the deity, when we offer all our food, when we share prasadam with our family, when we regularly invite devotees to come, and when we serve them prasad, have kirtan and have Krishna katha, we discuss these topics, our home becomes a sacred place. So it's not like a home where cats and dogs are living and we're fighting with each other all the time, because you're maintaining this atmosphere of Krishna consciousness, and you're putting, you know, in place these safety nets. You have devotees coming over regularly, you have good association, so you can share your and speak your minds out, take advice from other grihasthas. And another important principle, excuse me, is of course, as it has been stated time and time again, as grihasthas, it's our duty to maintain the other ashrams. So we should be taking care of the brahmacharis, we should be taking care of the sannyasis, and we should be providing for their needs as well. This is very auspicious for you as a grihastha and would assist you in your spiritual advancement, because you get the blessings of these devotees who are very sincere in their Krishna consciousness. Then likewise, those kind of blessings is auspicious for your grihastha ashram. And like I said, you know, inviting guests over for prasadam. It is the duty of the grihastha to feed others. And this has been seen in many examples in scripture as well, that, you know, the mood of hospitality. I mean, a perfect example is with Draupadi and Durvasya Muni, and how the great concern to ensure that your guests are properly taken care of, not just guests. It is said that one should, you know, before one takes prasad, one should go out and ring the bell, that, you know, prasad is ready, please come and take prasad. So in this way, it's auspicious and helps one, and one gets those good punya for one's own spiritual advancement. And we should not become kripanas, misers, where, you know, sometimes the trend is there, oh, so-and-so is here, he's going to want to come over, we're going to have to feel obliged to invite him over, and then we're going to have to provide prasad, then we have to give dakshin. It shouldn't be that mood. You need to set that example for your children. You know, it's good that they see, you know, there's some senior devotee that's in the area. If that senior devotee or that Maharaj comes over, it'll be a good atmosphere created in the home. The child will see how we respect devotees, how we, you know, and when they come in, they're going to engage in some Krishna katha. We're going to discuss some nice topics. The child is going to be exposed to this. And then when we give that dakshin and we serve, we go out of our way to try and make as much as these devotees I'm not hankering for good prasad or for fulfilling the palate, but they reciprocate by accepting the invitation so that, you know, they can engage you in your duty as a grihastha. And so they come and they oblige, and then they come to your house, and then in that way you are rendering some service, you're setting an example, and you're also getting blessings at the same time. So it's important that we set those examples. And a Krishna-conscious marriage is meant to bring us into greater alignment with our spiritual nature. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu advised the household of Kurma, remain at home and chant the holy name of Krishna always. Instruct everyone to follow the orders of Lord Sri Krishna as they are given in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. If you follow this instruction, your materialistic life at home will not obstruct your spiritual advancement. Indeed, if you follow these regulative principles, we will again meet here, or rather, you will never lose my company. So those regulative principles exist. It's not just being grihastha, but it's also maintaining those regulative principles. So I think I will stop at this point. And it's a bit early, but I could go on a bit more if necessary. But I think that, you know, we'll open it up for some discussion, comments, questions. I was saying that, you know, it's like naturally when there's attraction between boy and girl, then one begins to sometimes flirt and send out signals that I'm interested in you. Give out those kind of vibes that yes, I'm willing. You know, if that attraction may exist, but one could very well be reserved, because what gives you the license to approach the other sex and to make known your thoughts and your feelings? If the opposite sex that you're attracted to is a very strict person, then you feel a bit intimidated as to whether, if I approach the person, am I going to be rejected? Or, you know, will my advances be welcome? But if the person who's the object of your attention gives out these signals, then it's more likely that you feel more comfortable to approach the person. So therefore, if we are genuine that we want to remain in Brahmacharya Ashram, then we won't send out mixed signals. We won't kind of like be flirtatious, or in our talking be ambiguous, and kind of, are we testing that person to see how far they'd go as well? So, you know, it's a genuine way of knowing how willing a person is to take a relationship further, or to engage in a relationship, is by the kind of signals that they send out. It could be through body language, it could be through words. So that is, in that context, it's flirting. Like, yeah, King Agnidra, it is said that he used flattery. So his intention was that he wanted to make this woman into his wife. So he immediately, so by using flattery, you know, you boost someone's ego, and then they feel, you know, with this bloated ego, they feel so good. You make them feel that, you know, you are such a good person. So then they in return see the good in you. Oh, he must be a good man if he says such good things to me. And I think the Prabhu who gave the class the other day, I remember him saying that women like to hear good things and men like to see good things. Men are attracted with their sight and women are attracted by what they hear. So just like this King Agnidra is like using flattery because he knows that's going to impress the women. Men are attracted, like in the previous verses here, King Agnidra was like so full of visual images. There's like those preceding verses are so full of visual images, describing the way she looked and how he was bewildered as to whether this is good-looking boy, or is it, you know, he was like, the way he spoke earlier verses was like, you know, he's a bit confused. So in that sense, flattery is something that is normally used, or one flirts, but it's not something that we as devotees should be doing. You know, we should be very guarded in our decorum, in the way we present ourselves. And yes, there's a proper way of approaching the opposite sex if one intends changing one's ashram. We do it in consultation with the senior devotees and through the authorities. So, Prabhu, you had a question or a comment? Thank you. To be honest with you, I'm not certain what is the degree of compatibility, but I don't... I would say, at least in my opinion, this is, and I hate to speculate, but if I'm being asked in my opinion, then I would say at least 75-80%, because it's not often, especially within, to find a devotee within our own community, to find someone that's going to be 100% compatible with another person. And we have limited choices because we're a community where we'd want to seek from within our community that partner. So I would say that one would not always find 100% compatibility. And, you know, even within ISKCON, I don't know to what degree astrological calculations are taken into account. Sometimes one just finds devotees that have similar interests, and it's like we say, common Western term, to find the other half. One hopes that the other half makes one whole in the sense that they complement you, you know, in what you lack, and therefore you can function as a whole, as a unit. The two of you as a unit can function as a whole because you bring into the marriage that which the other lacks, and your strengths help and with their weaknesses, and their strengths help with your weaknesses, and we can kind of grow together in that way. So I know it's very common amongst the Indian community up until now to still look into astrology to find the suitors of their child. And, it's not very common, my understanding is, in currently within ISKCON, to what degree we actually depend on astrological calculations. And generally we depend on, you know, if we have the blessings of the guru and we have the blessings of the senior Vaishnavs, then we know that we have the support system of theirs as well. And I was put, from my own personal example, I was put into somewhat of a quandary because my Guru Maharaj, when the marriage proposal came and I had approached him, and he said, you know what, I have no objection if your parents have no objection. And my parents were that they have no objection if my Guru Maharaj has no objection. So it was almost like, you know what, you have my support, and reversing the role to that of the parents. So the parents also have to assume responsibility in the future. And I think that is where the extended family situation assists in the sustenance of that marriage. And I think in Indian families that kind of like had a good safety net in place, because especially if the spouses were chosen by the parents, then when difficulties arose in the marriage relationship, the parents would kind of assist. But in Western culture, and even amongst Indians right now, we have this ideology of the mother-in-law, the wicked mother-in-law. You know? But I think in devotee community, we see the mother-in-law as well, if she's a devotee, as that she would be there ideally to assist us in our spiritual lives. And also in that extended family situation, you have grandparents playing a good role in the future of raising those grandchildren as well. And in that way, we, you know, it assists each other. And so where we may not have astrological calculations done in our marriages, maybe they haven't been done, or we are entering and we don't know whether we should do it or not, I think we take the guidance of our spiritual authorities in that respect. Yes, I was born and raised in South Africa within an Indian community. No. I would say, as I was growing up, there was very little, if no, talk about divorce. Today it's very prevalent. It's almost, I would say, the statistics are almost equal to those persons not of Indian origin. I have done many divorce cases, and I go to court. So when I'm sitting in court and I'm seeing all these other divorce cases before myself, the statistics are equal, I would say, in terms of, if we're looking at racial demographics, in the number of cases that are being heard on that particular day, I would say they in equal percentages. And people are more inclined to opt out of a marriage very easily rather than trying to make it work. And also, you know, like we are hoping that in terms of our justice system, that mediation becomes part of, instead of litigation, that divorce moves towards the trends of mediation. And we have put in, the government or the legislature has put into place an office called the Office of the Family Advocate. And so in divorce cases where there is going to be a custody issue, so parents would have to go to this Office of the Family Advocate, which is meant to be some objective office which provides guidance for the courts in deciding on who should get custody of this child and to what extent the other parent, the non-custodian, should have access to that child as well. So, you know, whilst I say that I grew up in an environment where divorce was taboo, if someone had been divorced, it was like they were looked at, you know, that's like almost like an outcast. And whilst I say that, I should also say that at the same time, a person, you know, premarital sex was not existence. And to find someone being pregnant before marriage also brought the reputation of that family from where that girl came into disrepute. So we were raised in an environment where we were consciously told that, you know, do not bring disrepute to this family. And these are the kind of acts that would bring disrepute. So I think, you know, maybe that's a good point as well, that sometimes as devotees, and I've done this with the parenting workshop, we are so guarded about bringing our children into Krishna consciousness and giving them all these ideal concepts that we sometimes omit to educate them about, you know, I would think that once a child is reaching the stage of puberty and adolescence, instead of them learning about sex education in school, we should properly educate them. We are not sending them to the Gurukul or to the ashram of the guru where they're going into the proper brahmacharya institution. So in our roles, we should also educate them as they're growing up. That, you know, this is the we don't necessarily say these are the regulative principles. No, don't. But try to present it to them in a positive fashion. The consequences of doing this is that you are going to land up in this situation. Are you ready to be a mother at the age of 12 or 13 and take on that responsibility? So that they can make informed choices. Thank you, Prabhu. Yes, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's like you said, you know, in Prabhupada, you know, he didn't want them to live like cats and dogs. So many of them who had just come to Krishna consciousness were already coming together with their girlfriends and their boyfriends. So he would say, better you get married. He was trying to make gentlemen and gentlewomen out of these people that were coming to ISKCON. And of course, Prabhupada could not play an active role in each and every one of those devotees' lives, hoping that, you know, that they would progress nicely and advance together. But yes, it's not always possible, especially in the early days, for when everyone was taking so quickly and so intensely to Krishna consciousness, not necessarily taking baby steps. One joined, you know, currently, and we can see how ISKCON has evolved over the years, from a point where everyone lived in the temple, to now we are at this point where few live in the temple and many live outside of the temple, so we have a bigger devotee community outside of the temple than within the temple. So, but that facility did not exist. Srila Prabhupada needed to create the temple so that everyone could come there for their spiritual nourishment and their growth. And because they were coming from cultures, like you say, where they had no exposure to this lifestyle, so then they suddenly went from living those lives to coming into a situation where all these rules and regulations were there, and to whatever degree one had that control over oneself and to one's degree of commitment. And of course, something that comes out from that is that we sometimes have that internal struggle between ourselves. We want to aspire to fulfill all these responsibilities and rules so that we can live these ideal lives, but at the same time our material conditioning is so strong, or we're so exposed to something that we are unable to overcome those challenges that we, and yes, we'll have our fall downs, but you know, like whatever acts one performs in Krishna consciousness is never to one's loss. So we will try to, and therefore we should try and maintain that devotee association. Or even if you see if a devotee is having these difficulties, when one should not think, oh no, he's fallen down and he's left ISKCON or what. We should try to assist them and see, you know, how we can assist others in the Grihastha Ashram as well. And of course, like I said in the parenting seminar as well, it takes a village to raise a child. And so when others come to offer advice or comments or even criticism, and I say it should be positive criticism, don't only point out a person's faults, but give them the solutions and offer to assist. So if we adopt that attitude of it takes a village to raise a child, then we appreciate each other's comments, advice, and together with that advice and comments is going to come the fact that they're going to assist us, hold us by the hands, and help us through these difficulties that we have. Yeah, a woman should actually be chaste. So, the best is that if she has this on her mind, she approaches the authorities, and the authorities would ideally know what is that devotee like and what his aspirations are, whether he intends changing and becoming a grihastha or not. And the authorities kind of facilitate the arrangement where it is possible. But if one is not prepared to reveal one's mind to one's authority, it's also very difficult to control one's mind. And to think that I'm going to be able to control it by myself is also, unless one is really fixed, and one would not be able to, and would kind of maybe unconsciously send out signals as well. Or it could lead to great frustration within a person. But at the same time, you know, like it's good if she doesn't want to reveal her mind to the authorities, then she's taking it, then she should really try, as she's adopted the attitude that I'm here, and if it's meant to happen, it will happen. Then she should accept it and focus more on her sadhana. And I think Krishna, as the super soul within, will direct her If she's not going to reveal her mind, she's going to have to really be more surrendered to a good sadhana and to good, you know, keep herself very nicely engaged in devotional service so she doesn't get frustrated, so that she doesn't, you know, act impulsively on her thoughts as well. And at the same time, Krishna will make arrangements, whether it's that person or it's someone else. If he knows the desire is there, he will create the situation where it will become a nice, healthy situation for her. That he would not appreciate it, or she would not appreciate it? Okay, I really can't understand that properly, but I would think that it would be good for a woman, as part of her chastity, to not approach the person directly. But in not appreciating him, I can't understand that properly, yeah. So maybe we can speak a bit later. Yeah. So, you know, like I was saying, the Prabhu raised the point about having been raised in an Indian family in South Africa. You know, not many years ago, I mean, less than 3 decades ago, when I was in my adolescence, it was not uncommon for people to come with a marriage proposal from another family. And I was at the age of about 13, I think it was, there was another family that approached my parents that they would like to have their son married to me. Unfortunately, my father said no. I would dread to think, you know, that a child could be married off at the age of 13. But in previous generations, it was not uncommon for when a girl reaches puberty for them to marry the child off, because they know that the sex impulse is going to be there, and rather it be regulated and it be into a nice family that where they know the their prospective son-in-law's family, and that the compatibility and all is done. So the woman is also kept under the protection of the family, and they know that she's chaste. Instead of, as she grows older, she becomes more open-minded and picky in her suitors, and she could have the tendency to become promiscuous. Then it didn't work out with him, so I'll try it out with that person, and in that way we lose our self-worth as well, because we're engaging in too many relationships. You know, like the first person you meet, you so-called fall in love with, and then you have a relationship and it doesn't work out. So it didn't work out there. We try the next person. We want to get married, but we're just finding the right person to get married to. And so by the time, you know, you like kind of moved around too often, that your reputation is tainted. And then at the same time, it's like once your reputation is tainted, who wants to marry someone who's been with so many people? And I say this particularly for girls, you know. So the ideal, you know, life is that to choose, for rather that to marry someone after the compatibility, and you understand that you share the same value system, then one should get into the ashram. And one looks at bygone days where parents, you know, statistics comparatively, where marriages were arranged. Those marriages lasted longer than those marriages of today. And that is because we also have that impetus that I've got to make it work. We never had the option of divorce. So we will make it work. I mean, my grandparents, their marriage lasted a lifetime. My parents are married for 42 years now. And, you know, the one moving on to Vanaprastha and things like that. But we see with those marriages that they've lasted a long time, and those marriages were like done at a time where, you know, they were very conscious of their reputations. So they tried to make it work. You know, when I look at it now, I'm looking at it from the point of an attorney, as a lawyer. And one would look at what the legal system says about situations like that. And in terms of our legal system in South Africa, one would leave a will behind, you know, the last will and testament of what is your intentions in the event of either, if both parents dying simultaneously, then the guardianship of this child should go to so-and-so. So if we would like for devotees to become guardians of our children, we should actually put it into our wills. Because if we do not put it into our will, then it leaves it open for our next of kin, your brother, your mother, who may not be devotees, to come and claim responsibility for this child. So I think the way to address that is to ensure that our intentions are expressed and that we seriously consider that. That, you know, death can come at any moment. So what arrangements have I made for my child? Do we want to leave our child in a situation where someone who's had no relationship with them, who is not Krishna consciousness, suddenly is awarded custody of this child by the legal system? Yeah. Like I have a really, I have a good friend who's a Christian, and I did her will for her, and you know, they've already made it known that these are the godparents of that child. So if we kind of do that as well, that you know, I find you to be the godparent, and let that relationship build between that child during our lifetimes with that person, so we can see the kind of. Obviously, your choice will be based on what their value system is and their, you know, how good the parents they're going to be. And that person will play a role, you know, in their lives from now. And you would be able to see those that take care of your children would be the ideal people. And then they must also be willing to take on that responsibility. It's one thing that you have that desire that that person's going to be the godparent, but that person has no inclination. Yeah. Thank you. Hare Krishna.